The digital station on radio, TV and online. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Now, Sinead Cusack continues to read from Frances Stoner Saunders' account of the troubled life of Violet Gibson, the daughter of an Anglo-Irish lord and who attempted to assassinate Mussolini in Rome in 1926. This is episode 3. Mussolini was a man with a passion for living dangerously. His battle scars and near misses testify to that, and it was the heroic legend that he stoked which so enthused his supporters. But then Violet came to feel differently. The woman who shot Mussolini.
In 1922, whilst visiting her brother Willie and his wife Marianne, Violet told them that the Pope had betrayed the Church and should be eliminated. Both were shocked and concerned for her state of mind. She had ample motive for wishing to confront the Pontiff, for his hostility to Catholic modernism, his autocratic detachment from the aims of Christian socialism, and for his silence over fascism's daily mugging of fundamental liberties. Her intellect drew her inexorably into the theology of murder. It was a labyrinthine subject, crammed with contradictory messages. In Exodus, the position is clear, thou shalt not murder. But elsewhere in the Bible, the Israelites are commanded to kill. Saint Michael used force to expel Adam and Eve from paradise. A Dominican friar, convinced he was doing God's work, assassinated Henry III of France. Violet tussled with a whole raft of precedents that seemed to justify selective killing. One in particular caught her attention. Her close friend, Enid Dinas, wrote an account of what happened next. Violet was in a low state of depression and dwelling on the fact that more suffering was required of her. She was ill and feverish. She left the house in the middle of the night in her night things and was brought back by two policemen who knew her by sight. In the morning she slipped out and the housekeeper's daughter followed her to bring her back. Miss Gibson went down to the cellar area of her house and took a knife out of her bag. It was the knife that she used for bookbinding which lay on her table. The girl who had followed her screamed and the police came. The girl's hands and face were cut. On this occasion, Miss Gibson was certified as insane and taken to the mental home at Virginia Water. I saw her there soon after, and she told me that she had been under the impression that she was doing something great for God and His Church. This was a confidence which she carefully kept from the doctors. On the occasion when she went out with a knife, we found by her bedside her Bible, open at the chapter in Genesis containing the story of Abraham and the sacrifice of Isaac. After 5 months in the sanatorium in Virginia Water, Violet went straight to Grosvenor Crescent, where Constance lived with their mother, the Dowager Lady Ashbourne. Dinas, who visited often, discerned a slight improvement, but was troubled by Violet's repeated questions about whether or not it was right to kill. She asked me to give her an assurance that I did not think so, and demanded a definite denial. From the days during the First World War, when Treasury money lubricated his editorial rants, to the moment he invaded Ethiopia in October 1935, Mussolini basked in the approval of the British. His first foreign visit as Premier had been to England, where, in December 1922, he was received by the Prime Minister and the King, and laid a wreath at the cenotaph. Large crowds gathered wherever he went, including British blackshirts who sang Giovinezza gustily and with terrible pronunciation. Mussolini, who liked to boast that he slept in his underclothes like a real working man and didn't own a pair of pyjamas, put up at Claridge's and missed a press conference because he was in bed with a prostitute. But the overall impression he left was that he was a man with whom one could do business. There was no serious interrogation in the British Embassy or the Foreign Office of the utter pretentiousness, the emptiness, even the madness, the folie de grandeur and megalomania of Mussolini's regime. British policy was stato forte, stability in Italy at any cost. Violet, now living on her own again in Kensington, had been monitoring developments in Italy with growing horror. Mussolini's betrayal of socialism, the silence of the Vatican, and the brutal incursions into her vision of Italy as the land of Dante, Fra Angelico, St. Francis, these were flagrant assaults on both God and liberty, the principles that Violet was committed to defending. Still uncertain about her role in the divine plan, she waited for a sign. On the 6th of November 1924, the hapless Mary McGrath, a hired nurse companion from County Meath, embarked for Rome with Violet. Enid Dinnis later recounted, "She only told me the day before and I was powerless to do anything. I could only hope that her family would take steps to keep an eye on her." Violet had assembled her clothes and belongings in great haste, but she had time enough to include in her luggage a small revolver. If Violet was not carrying the revolver for her own protection, what was it for? Was the Pope her original target? Her friend Enid Dinnis certainly thought so. When Miss Gibson's friends heard that she was at large again in Rome, they nearly all of them expressed the same fear, that she would shoot the Holy Father. We all feared it. I never heard her speak of Signor Mussolini. Violet had acquired letters of introduction from priests in London, and these she presented to various eminent clerics in Rome, including Father Fedele de Stotzingen, a German Benedictine. De Stotzingen would later tell police that he met Violet soon after she arrived in November 1924. In the first instance, she asked him to arrange an audience with the Pope, a request he decided not to pursue. 2 or 3 weeks later, she asked him to be her spiritual confessor, to take direction of her soul. This he declined. She also asked him if she should do what it was God was asking of her. He was under the impression that she meant to found a religious institution and thought little more of the matter. Stotzingen's refusal to become Violet's confessor was a cruel blow. She was, indeed, on a mission, but it was not of the kind that he and the nuns surmised. She was struggling with her conscience. Should she kill? Was this the sacrifice God required of her? She needed help, spiritual guidance, and in Rome, of all places, she had difficulty in finding it. On the evening of Friday, the 27th of February, 1925, Violet withdrew to her room in the convent. She read a few passages from the Bible, lit some candles on an improvised altar, knelt down, held a pistol to her chest, there where her left breast had been removed, and pulled the trigger. Hearing the noise echo through the convent, the nuns rushed to her room and banged on the door. Violet managed to get to her feet and drag herself to the bed, in which position the nuns found her. According to Mary McGrath, who had also rushed to the scene, Violet was bleeding slightly from the mouth. There was no other injury immediately visible. Indeed, as Violet had pulled the sheets up to her chin before allowing the nuns to enter, there was no obvious signs of what had happened. McGrath saw the revolver and asked her what she had done. "I wanted to die for the glory of God," came the reply. Violet forbade her to call a doctor before calling a priest. Believing her to be close to death, the nuns complied and called an English priest. Only after seeing him did Violet finally allow herself to be examined by a doctor and taken to hospital, where surgeons discovered that the bullet had entered just above the heart, bounced off a rib, and lodged itself in her shoulder, leaving her miraculously with no serious injury. They removed the bullet and sedated her, most likely with laudanum. 4 days after she shot herself, Willie arrived by train from Paris to persuade his sister to return to London. She refused. He stayed nearly a month, walking around Rome in his tam-o'-shanter, his cloak tossed over his back, a saffron kilt exposing a pair of rugged knees, and in his hand a blackthorn stick of generous proportions. This attire created the impression in the British Embassy that he was as mad as his sister. Meanwhile, in London, solicitors acting for the Dowager Lady Ashbourne and the family asked the Board of Control of Lunacy for advice as to the steps which could and ought to be taken for Violet's care on her return to England. It was probably knowledge of her family's intention to have her committed that finally induced Violet to go to a rest home in Rome, where she could be attended to by a psychiatrist and nurses. Violet remained in the clinic for almost 2 months and was visited daily by the faithful McGrath, who had moved to the nearby convent of Santa Brigida to be closer to her. In April, Violet joined her companion at the convent, where she was to reside for almost a year. Violet had refused to tell anyone where she had obtained the revolver. Her reserve in this, as in other matters, was disciplined, non-negotiable. The weapon was now in the custody of the police, to whom the nervous nuns had reported the incident. McGrath would later testify that she took to searching among Violet's trunks to see if she had any arms, even a pair of scissors. Clearly, her searches were not thorough enough, for in time, Violet would acquire another pistol and turn it on Mussolini, apparently with God's blessing, if not that of his representatives on earth. On the morning of Sunday, the 21st of March, 1926, Violet received a telegram. "Mother seriously ill. Have written fully. Constance." Violet rushed to Rome's Termini station to inquire about trains to England. She was planning her route back to a final reconciliation with her mother, even at the considerable risk of being committed by her family. But she didn't take the Tuesday train, because that afternoon a second telegram arrived. "Mother died peacefully today. Constance." A week later, Violet dismissed McGrath, seemingly preparing herself to act. Violet was now completely on her own. In her notebook she wrote, "There is no pain except in the hesitancy to accept the cross." She was facing her own Calvary. Still she dithered, trying to repair this decision by asking Enid Dinas to come immediately to Rome. At 10:15 a.m. on Thursday, the 1st of April, she sent her a telegram, "Come, Violet." But Dinas's brother was ill. She could not, did not come. "My dear, dear Violet," Dinas wrote by letter on the 6th of April, "I had a bad pain yesterday at the thought that I was not starting off for Rome. I ached. I don't like to think of you dead beat and a Good Friday between you and a rest. I feel anxious and keep thinking of you. I want you to put your feet up on the couch." Violet did not rest that day or the next. The long and tortuous inner struggle was over. The great mission was underway.
Tomorrow, moments after she'd shot Benito Mussolini, Violet Gibson seemed confused. Or was it an act of sanity? Sinead Cusack was reading The Woman Who Shot Mussolini by Frances Stonor Saunders. It was abridged by Jill Waters, and it's a Waters Company production for BBC Radio.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
It's 3 o'clock. Hello, this is Susan Ray with classic drama of the highest order, a big, meaty Russian tale that gets right down deep into life. It's Dostoevsky's final novel, The Brothers Karamazov. You'll need more than the usual tea and digestives for this hour. See if you've got a drop of vodka in the sideboard or some borscht in the fridge. Tonight, there are workforce problems in hell while Satan learns who truly wields power. Old Harry's game in the Comedy Club, which opens at 10. The Brothers Karamazov is a passionate, philosophical novel set in 19th century Russia that enters deeply into the ethical debates of God, free will and morality. It's a spiritual drama of moral struggles concerning faith, doubt and reason set against a modernising Russia. Dostoevsky intended it to be the first part in an epic story titled The Life of a Great Sinner, but he died less than 4 months after its publication. Since then, it's been acclaimed as one of the supreme achievements in literature. Part 1. Russia, 1880. The unpredictable Fyodor Karamazov and his sons are reunited to discuss Dmitri's inheritance.
Why are you so nervous, eh? So restless. Stop pacing up and down and come and sit quietly next to me.
I am sitting next to you, Father.
But you would like to be up and pacing around the room. You would like to be wringing your hands. You would like to be praying to God that your family don't make a fool of you and an exhibition of themselves. It's a sham. This sitting modestly next to me in your little monk's robe. I know you, Alyosha. You're my son. For all you wish you weren't. Now, don't protest. Aren't you going to protest? I'm leaving.
Please, he will be here very soon.
Tell me, why do you love this elder of yours so?
He's...
Yeah, I know, he's a saint. The great conciliator, the man who has brought more warring families together than I've had hot... Well, dinners. The polite expression is hot dinners. Let us stick with that. We are in a monastery, after all. Tell me this. Do you secretly hope he doesn't come? Dmitri, I mean?
Of course not.
What a sweet little creature you are. So like your mother. Dmitri's mother was a hellcat, but by far the better in bed. It's a sad fact that that's always the way.
I don't mind when you say things like that.
Dmitri is a dirty, blood-sucking devil. Do you mind if I say that? Well, let's not quarrel. Actually, the real reason I agreed to come wasn't to find peace and reconciliation with Dmitri. No, it was to see this holy man, this elder, this living saint, my beloved Alyosha, has fallen in love with.
You will like him, truly. Even the most hardened sinners leave his presence smiling like children.
Why do people always say such sentimental things about children? I never do. Every son is born with a spade in his hand ready to bury his father. Even you. Yeah, even you.
That's not true.
You think you're not a sinner like everyone else? That's the crime of Lucifer. Pride. He was God's favourite son, as you are mine, today at least. I'm ready for some brandy.
I could ask for some tea.
Tea? What will this spiritual marvel say when we lay our family's nasty little quarrels before him? Huh? You must have some notion. This whole gathering was your idea. Do you imagine Dmitri and me weeping on each other's necks while a chorus of monks sing Hallelujah? Did he ever shut up, by the way? Sets my teeth on edge, the singing. I hope I behave myself. You will correct me if I say the wrong thing. Now, I wish you would. Oh, how I long to be corrected. By a nice, stout peasant girl. No, not by you.